Okay, we're going to read today's birthdays. First up, we have Evelyn Jones of Shenandoah. Evelyn was born this date in 1923. Happy birthday, Evelyn. We have also Paul Culver of Fort Dodge, Georgianne Voigt of Des Moines, Scott Marchant of Newton, and Kristen Mills of Des Moines. Happy birthday to all of you. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now we'll turn to Sally for today's obituaries.
We have one obituary today for Robert Kenneth Levy. Robert Bob Levy, age 71, passed away suddenly Saturday, March 9th, after a lengthy battle with cancer and the pain that comes with it. Bob was a loving husband to his wife Vicky for over 30 years. He was also a jack of all trades, and there was nothing he couldn't fix or invent. He lived most of his life in Des Moines, working for his own construction business and built many homes and businesses in the area. He will be greatly missed by his wife, Vicky Levy, his three children, Kenny, his wife, Amy Levy, Nikki, Brian Levy Kerr, and Brandy, Brian Ponce, and two grandchildren, Ari and Max Ponce. Bob's wishes were to be cremated, and no services are planned at this time.
Okay, we're going to go back to our national news. Biden budget would hike spending 4.6%, says plan would reduce deficit by $3 trillion. By Michael Collins and Joey Garrison. Out of Washington, President Joe Biden released a federal budget Monday that seeks to protect entitlements and reduce the deficit by $3 trillion over the next decade by raising taxes on corporations and the wealthiest Americans. Biden's $7.3 trillion budget for the 2025 fiscal year, a 4.6% increase over the current budget, seeks to boost defense spending by 1.8% and non-defense discretionary spending by 2.7%. The spending falls below caps that House Republicans pushed in last year's Fiscal Responsibility Act that raised the debt limit. Although the budget has no chance of advancing in the GOP-controlled House of Representatives, it establishes Biden's priorities for his campaign against likely Republican nominee Donald Trump, particularly his efforts to appeal to working-class voters. We are the only nation that has emerged from every crisis we have entered stronger than we went in. While my administration has seen great progress since day one, there is still work to do. My budget will help make that promise real, Biden wrote in a budget document to Congress. Biden's budget proposes tax hikes on billionaires and corporations to cut the deficit by $3 trillion over the next 10 years while not reducing spending on entitlements. The president would reverse the corporate tax rate cut that Trump and congressional Republicans passed in 2017 by raising the rate from 21% to 28%. Biden is also pushing to increase a new minimum on the largest billion-dollar corporations, which he signed into law in 2022, from 15% to 21%. The president's budget includes a new 25% minimum tax on the wealthiest 0.1% of Americans. No, I'm sorry. Let me read that again. 0.01% of Americans, those with wealth over $100 million. And he is calling for new plans to deny tax deductions for corporations that pay any employee more than $1 million and to close a loophole that gives tax breaks to owners of corporate jets. Biden, who regularly accuses Republicans of wanting to slash Medicare and Social Security, bolsters spending for both programs in his budget. He proposes to extend the solvency of Medicare by increasing the Medicare tax rate on Americans who earn more than $400,000 a year, closing various loopholes in existing Medicare taxes, and directing revenue from the net investment income tax. The White House has not proposed a similar plan to extend the solvency of Social Security, but has outlined steady spending increases over the next 10 years. The 2025 budget would spend 6.2% more on Social Security than the current year. Social Security and Medicare are more than government programs, said Shalanda Young, director of the Office of Management and Budget. They're a promise, a rock-solid guarantee that generations of Americans have counted on. Biden and Democrats have long attacked Republicans by warning they can't be trusted to protect Medicare and Social Security. On Monday, the White House seized on remarks Trump made in an interview with CNBC, in which the former president said, "There is a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting." Biden sought $13.6 billion in emergency funding from Congress last fall to manage the surge of arrivals at the U.S.-Mexico border. But after Trump opposed a bipartisan border security bill, House Republicans tanked it. "Up to now, politics has intervened," Biden said Monday in remarks to the National League of Cities. "We have to end the games." Biden's proposal again calls for measures to improve security and deal with immigration at the southern border. The plan includes $405 million to hire 1,300 Border Patrol agents, $755 million to hire 1,600 asylum officers and support staff to handle immigration cases more quickly, and $239 million for 1,000 Customs and Border Patrol officers to stop fentanyl and other contraband from entering the country. It would allocate $849 million for cutting-edge technology to detect illicit drugs and other contraband at ports of entry. In addition, Biden is asking for $1.3 billion to hire 375 immigration judge teams to reduce the backlog of immigration cases. The president also proposed a $4.7 billion contingency fund that the Department of Homeland Security could tap to boost security operations if there is a migrant surge at the southwest border. The fund would receive annual appropriations. Biden offered several proposals to lower cost for families who are struggling financially. The president's budget would restore the full child tax credit enacted in the American Rescue Plan. Under that law, the maximum tax credit increased from $2,000 to $3,600 per child under age 6 and to $3,000 per child age 6 to 17. Congress allowed the credit to expire at the end of 2021. Biden also is proposing a new program under which working families with incomes up to $200,000 per year would be guaranteed affordable, high-quality child care from birth until kindergarten. Under the proposal, most families would pay no more than $10 a day. The lowest income families would pay nothing. The administration says the proposal would benefit the parents of more than 16 million children. To help expand home ownership, Biden is proposing a new mortgage relief credit to help increase access to affordable housing. The proposal includes a new tax credit for middle-class, first-time owners of up to $10,000 over 2 years. Biden is also calling on Congress to provide a one-year tax credit of up to $10,000 to middle-class families who sell their starter home. Biden's spending plan now goes to Congress, which is in charge of writing the federal budget. The president's proposal will become the starting point for negotiations between lawmakers and the White House. However, the House is unlikely to go along with many of the president's proposals, especially those to let tax breaks for wealthy people expire. So the final budget is expected to look far different from the document Biden proposed Monday.
Settlement reached on Florida's Don't Say Gay law. Students and teachers can discuss sexual orientation and gender identity in Florida classrooms, provided it's not part of instruction, under a settlement reached Monday between Florida education officials and civil rights attorneys who had challenged a state law which critics dubbed Don't Say Gay. The settlement clarifies what is allowed in Florida classrooms following passage 2 years ago of the law prohibiting instruction on sexual orientation and gender identity in early grades. Opponents said the law had created confusion about whether teachers could identify themselves as LGBTQ+, or if they even could have rainbow stickers in classrooms. Other states use the Florida law as a template to pass prohibitions on classroom instruction on gender identity or sexual orientation. Alabama, Arkansas, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, and North Carolina are among the states with versions of the law. Under the terms of the settlement, the Florida Board of Education will send instructions to every school district saying the Florida law doesn't prohibit discussing LGBTQ+ people, nor prevent anti-bullying rules on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, or disallow gay-straight alliance groups. The settlement also spells out that the law is neutral, meaning what applies to LGBTQ+ people also applies to heterosexual people, and that it doesn't apply to library books not being used for instruction in the classroom. The law also doesn't apply to books with incidental references to LGBTQ+ characters or same-sex couples, as they are not instruction on sexual orientation or gender identity any more than a math problem asking students to add bushels of apples is instruction on apple farming, according to the settlement. What this settlement does is it reestablishes the fundamental principle that I hope all Americans agree with, which is every kid in this country is entitled to an education at a public school where they feel safe, their dignity is respected, and where their families and parents are welcomed, Roberta Kaplan, the lead attorney for the plaintiff, said in an interview. This shouldn't be a controversial thing. In a statement, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' office described the deal as a major win, with the law formerly known as the Parental Rights in Education Act remaining intact. We fought hard to ensure this law couldn't be maligned in court, as it was in the public arena by the media and large corporate actors, said Ryan Newman, an attorney for the state of Florida. We are victorious, and Florida's classrooms will remain a safe place under the Parental Rights in Education Act. DeSantis has championed the law since before its passage in 2022 by the GOP-controlled Florida legislature. It barred instruction on sexual orientation and gender identity in kindergarten through the third grade, and it was expanded to all grades last year. Republican lawmakers had argued that parents should broach these subjects with children and that the law protected children from being taught about inappropriate material. But opponents of the law said it created a chilling effect in classrooms. Some teachers said they were unsure if they could mention or display a photo of their same-sex partner in their classroom. In some cases, books dealing with LGBTQ+ topics were removed from classrooms, and lines mentioning sexual orientation were excised from school musicals. The Miami-Dade County School Board in 2022 decided not to adopt a resolution recognizing LGBTQ History Month, even though it had done so a year earlier. The law also triggered the ongoing legal battles between DeSantis and Disney over control of the governing district for Disney World in Central Florida after DeSantis took control of the government in what the company described as retaliation for its opposition to the legislation. DeSantis touted the fight with Disney during his run for the 2024 GOP presidential nomination, which he ended earlier this year. The civil rights attorneys sued Florida education officials on behalf of teachers, students, and parents, claiming the law was unconstitutional, but the case was dismissed last year by a federal judge in Tallahassee who said they lacked standing to sue. The case was appealed to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Kaplan said they believed the appellate court would have reversed the lower court's decision, but continuing the lawsuit would have delayed any resolution for several more years. The last thing we wanted for the kids in Florida was more delay, Kaplan said.
Video would aim to clarify abortion bans. GOP leaders accuse doctors of political gamemanship. It's out of Nashville, Tennessee. In Republican-led states across the U.S., conservative legislators are refusing to reevaluate abortion bans, even as doctors and patients insist the law's exceptions are dangerously unclear, resulting in denied treatment to some pregnant women in need. Instead, GOP leaders accuse abortion rights advocates of deliberately spreading misinformation and doctors of intentionally denying services in an effort to undercut the bans and make a political point. At the same time, however, some states are taking steps that they say will provide more clarity about when abortions can be legally performed. The Republican-controlled South Dakota legislature wants to create a video in which medical experts and the state's attorneys would explain to doctors and patients when abortions can be legally performed. The measure was passed last month and is now awaiting the signature of Republican Governor Kristi Noem, who has indicated she will sign it. The First in the Nation idea is wholeheartedly supported by SBA Pro-Life, one of the country's largest anti-abortion groups, which says the video will help to combat confusion caused by the abortion industry. South Dakota is showing the rest of the nation how to protect women's lives from the misinformation surrounding abortion laws, said the organization's public affairs director in South Dakota, Kelsey Pritchard. Oklahoma and Kentucky are also taking steps to clarify their abortion bans, though in both states, the attorneys general, not physicians, are the ones dictating the terms. In Oklahoma, the AG sent out a memo in 2022 informing prosecutors and police that doctors should have substantial leeway to provide certain abortions. Last year, the office added that patients don't have to be septic, bleeding profusely, or otherwise close to death, but reiterated a past warning that doctors should be prosecuted if there's evidence they violated the law by providing an abortion when a woman's life wasn't actually in danger. Kentucky's attorney general has stated that miscarriages and ectopic pregnancies, when a fertilized egg grows outside the uterus, are both exempted from the state's abortion ban, but has been silent on the majority of other pregnancy complications that physicians and patients have pointed out. Since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the constitutional right to abortion in 2022, states have been free to enact their own restrictions. South Dakota is among the 14 that ban abortion at all stages of pregnancy. The law does not allow an abortion exception to save the life of the mother. Let me read that again. I think I might have read it incorrectly. The law does allow an abortion exception to save the life of the mother. But like similar statutes in other states, it does not clearly define which pregnancy complications are considered life-threatening. State Republican Representative Taylor Rehfeldt, a nurse anesthetist, said she decided to propose the informational video after hearing from physicians about the ongoing confusion. She said the video offered the best solution because any attempt to tweak the abortion ban itself would provoke strong disagreement among her GOP colleagues. It remains to be seen how much help the video will be to patients and doctors, however. It's not expected to specifically list pregnancy complications that would legally qualify women for abortions, and it's unclear if it will contain a legal disclaimer warning that anyone who watches the video may still face potential criminal charges. It's not going to deal with hard calls, said Greer Donnelly, an associate professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, who is an expert on abortion law. They actually don't want to deal with the hard calls because their movement is not sure how those hard calls should be resolved. South Dakota Republican State Senator Aaron Tobin, one of the measure's proponents, acknowledged to a Senate panel last month that the video will not contain specific examples. That's the problem with healthcare, is that there are so many different circumstances that you have to allow doctors discretion, Tobin said. As some states mull how to clarify, without weakening, their abortion bans, abortion rights advocates in several states continue to challenge the bans with lawsuits. 20 Texas women denied abortions are suing the state seeking clarification, while advocates filed a lawsuit in Tennessee arguing that the state bans vaguely defined exceptions put pregnant women's lives at risk. Tennessee Attorney General Jonathan Scrimeti pushed back, He argued that it wasn't the law, per se, that is harming women, but rather other factors like doctors' independent choices not to provide permissible abortions. The lawsuit is ongoing, with attorneys expected to make their arguments before a 3-judge panel next month on whether the state ban should be temporarily blocked as the legal battle continues, or if the case should be dismissed entirely. Donnelly spurned the idea that doctors bear the responsibility for endangering patients. I completely reject any narrative that there's any sort of provider out there that's intentionally harming women and pregnant people for the sake of a news story, she said. That's just not happening. But are mistakes being made because people are terrified? Yeah, probably. In Texas, a pregnant woman whose fetus had a fatal condition went straight to the state Supreme Court last year to request an exemption from the Lone Star State's strict ban. The court denied Katie Cox's request, forcing her to go out of state to get an abortion, but did urge the Texas Medical Board to issue guidance to doctors on how to interpret the law. While the judiciary cannot compel executive branch entities to do their part, it is obvious that the legal process works more smoothly when they do, the justices wrote. And yet, the medical board, comprising 19 members appointed by the governor, has so far not offered any sort of guidance. Republican Governor Greg Abbott is a vocal abortion opponent. Frustrated with the board's inaction, Amy and Stephen Bresnan, a couple who are lawyers and lobbyists, filed a petition in January asking it to clarify what circumstances qualify as medical exemptions to the state's abortion ban. Pregnant females in life-threatening situations are the health care providers otherwise willing to sit. Let me start that again. I apologize. Pregnant females in life-threatening situations and the health care providers otherwise willing to save their lives simply cannot be required to stand idly in the void when the TMB, the Texas Medical Board, has the authority to act and the duty to regulate medicine in this state in the public interest, the petition states. The board is expected to meet later this month and will likely address the petition, Steve Bresnan said. Nobody has put them on the spit to make them make a formal decision, he said. If they decline to, they have to explain why.
Princess of Wales apologizes for altering family photo. Rumors about Kate's health are rampant. In London, Kate, Princess of Wales, apologized Monday for confusion caused by her altering of a family photo released by the palace, an image of Kate and her children that was intended to calm concern and speculation about the British royal's health, but had the opposite effect. Several news agencies that initially published the photo, including the Associated Press, withdrew the image over concerns about digital manipulation. Issued by the couple's Kensington Palace office on Sunday to mark Mother's Day in Britain, it was the first official photo of 42-year-old Kate since she had abdominal surgery nearly 2 months ago. The retractions sent the online rumor mill, already rampant with speculation over Kate's operation and recuperation, into overdrive. The PR disaster is more evidence that the royal family's long-held mantra, never complain, never explain, is impossible in a social media-saturated era. In a post on social media, Kate said that, like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing. I wanted to express my apologies for any confusion the family photograph we shared yesterday caused, the post said. In the past, the palace has issued several of Kate's family snapshots, featuring her and heir to the throne, Prince William, with their children, Prince George, 10, Princess Charlotte, 8, and Prince Louis, 5. The latest photo was taken by William, Kensington Palace said. In an accompanying social media message, Kate said, "Thank you for your kind wishes and continued support over the last 2 months. Wishing everyone a happy Mother's Day." While there was no suggestion the photo was fake, AP retracted it because closer inspection revealed the source had manipulated the image in a way that did not meet AP's photo standards. For instance, it contained an inconsistency in the alignment of Princess Charlotte's left hand with the sleeve of her sweater. Other major news agencies, including Getty, Reuters, AFP, and the UK National Agency, PA, also withdrew the photo. Kensington Palace said it would not release the original unedited photograph. And while Kate's statement provided a measure of clarification, it looked unlikely to stop the swirl of rumor that has accelerated during her absence from public duties. Former BBC royal correspondent Peter Hunt said the mishandled photo release is damaging for the royals. They knew there would be intense interest in any picture they released of Kate, he wrote on X, formerly known as Twitter. Their challenge is that people will now question whether they can be trusted and believed when they next issue a health update. The royal family is under particular scrutiny because King Charles III has also had to cancel public duties while he undergoes treatment for an unspecified form of cancer. The monarch has canceled all his public engagements, though he has been photographed walking to church and meeting privately with government officials and dignitaries. Charles's relative openness about his diagnosis was a departure for the generally secretive royal family, but it has been eclipsed in popular interest by curiosity over Kate's condition. In the absence of firm information, conspiracy theories have rushed to fill the vacuum on social media about what had happened to Kate since she left a hospital January 29th after a nearly two-week stay following planned surgery. She hadn't been seen publicly since Christmas Day. Kate underwent surgery January 16th, and her condition and the reason for the operation have not been revealed, though Kensington Palace said it was not cancer-related. Although the palace initially said that it would only provide significant updates and that she would not return to royal duties before Easter, March 31st this year, it followed up with a statement last month saying she was doing well. At the time, royal aides told the Sun newspaper, "We've seen the madness of social media, and that is not going to change our strategy. There has been much on social media, but the princess has a right to privacy and asks the public to respect that." Further questions were raised last week when the British military seemed to jump the gun in announcing Kate would attend a Trooping the Colour ceremony in June, apparently without consulting palace officials. It's up to palace officials, not government departments, to announce the royals' attendance at events. Kensington Palace didn't confirm any scheduled public events for Kate, and the army later removed reference to her attendance. William, Queen Camilla, and other senior royals attended a Commonwealth Day service at Westminster Abbey on Monday. Neither Kate nor the King was due to be at the event, which drew a crowd of several dozen anti-monarchist protesters holding signs reading "Down with the Crown." William was also due to speak at an event for the Earthshot Prize, an environmental competition that he founded. Veteran public relations consultant Mark Borkowski said the photo gaffe exposed a wider PR problem for the monarchy. "There doesn't seem to be that much joined-up strategic thinking at the heart of the royal family at the moment, which leads to these problems where it's a very difficult organization to manage in terms of PR," he said. "I find they have risen to the challenge," provided the statement as an explanation, he said, of Kate's apology Monday. "The question is, with all the conspiracy theories running around, is whether people believe it, and I'm not sure they will."
For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been myself, Teresa Whitaker, and Sally Ortkes. It's been our pleasure to read for you, and now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Doug Kretzinger and Scott Splavik. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and the USA Today. And here's Scott with our next article.
Thank you, Doug. I'll start with the editorial from the Des Moines Register. It's entitled, Lewis Would Bring a Fresh Perspective to Council. Justin Lewis is the candidate in next week's special Des Moines City Council election who can best broaden the horizons of discussions about the city's short and long-term needs. Lewis, age 34, who runs a landscaping business, brings a thoughtful platform to the campaign that focuses on accountability for government and stability for all Des Moines residents, including access to housing, food, and health care. We expect he would challenge the rest of the council to consider its incremental approaches to such topics as equitable, just policing, and houselessness. Mike Simonson, age 64, runs an architecture firm and has mounted an impressively well-organized campaign and earned a wide range of endorsements. He has put in the time, serving 12 years in the Des Moines Planning and Zoning Board, and has a deep command of issues confronting the council, particularly when it comes to housing. His experience and outlook suggest he would make a fine council member. We believe he would. Rather than any deficiency in Simonson, this endorsement is a reflection of Lewis's strength as a candidate. It is reminiscent of the scenario in the regular election in the fall of 2021 when Lewis was in a difficult matchup against incumbent Connie Bozen. Des Moines would have been well served with either candidate winning that election. Now, Lewis has a new opportunity to win the at-large seat, filling the unexpired term created by Bozen's election as mayor last fall. Claudia Addy, Rose Marie Smith, and Benjamin Clark are also on the ballot for the March 19th election, but none of them is as ready as Lewis and Simonson to step immediately into a challenging budget cycle on the council. A recent study argued that Polk County needs about three times the annual funding it now gives to housing, emergency shelter, and other resources, about $20 million more per year. Asked about that gap during an interview with the Register, Lewis wasn't deterred by the number of zeros in the figure or the fact that such shortfalls have persisted for various services that are vital to lower-income residents. He suggested working with companies to arrange volunteer time for their employees and renewing fundraising efforts with the private sector. So now we have cash. We have the sweat equity, and then, finally, how can we bolster these other corporations, these other nonprofits that are actually doing the work? How can we link up together and get more done faster? I think that's where we find it. $20 million seems like a lot. It does. But if we take one bite at a time, we can eat into it, he said. Similarly, he approached the financial woes of the Des Moines Area Regional Transit Authority from the perspective of what it would be like if bus service weren't around, including when he was growing up and attending East High School. DART was how I got to school. That's how I learned. That's how I made friends. That's how I got around, he said. Regardless of the outcome of the election, the council should take seriously one of the insights Simonson has offered, that today it's pretty much expected that if you want to develop something in the city of Des Moines, you are going to get some kind of financial incentives. He suggested the city analyze whether it could reduce the duration of tax abatement incentives it offers to projects. Voters should not make their decisions on candidates for public office based merely on demographics. It's true that the all-white Des Moines City Council does not reflect Des Moines' racial diversity, and only one council member still has school-aged children. But those facts alone don't mean that a younger person of color is the right choice for this election. Lewis, appropriately, stands on the strengths of his ideas. It's also true, however, that Lewis's election could prove a substantive benefit to the council and to the city because of his personal experiences and connections. He told the Register as much when answering a question about potential civilian review of Des Moines Police Department actions. We need different perspectives. We need women. We need men. We need people from all communities who have a different lived experience to say, I would look at that based off of this and my lived experience, and maybe not remove the officer, but let's do something some retraining on this specific culture, and let's understand why that person wears his pants that way. Let's be conscious of cultures. I don't think it's to punish cops. It's just more accountability. Lewis is the best choice to ensure habit-challenging discussions among council members. And this was written by Lucas Grundmeier on behalf of the Des Moines Register Editorial Board.
And here are some letters to the editor on the Des Moines Register. Republicans want to have it both ways. How do Republican right-to-life conservatives justify being for in vitro fertilization? Shouldn't they be agreeing with the Alabama Supreme Court that the embryos are living human beings and should not be killed? In essence, how they are saying it's okay for embryos to be sacrificed so a woman who wants a child can get pregnant, but it's not okay for a teenager who is raped to end a pregnancy because she's not ready for a child. The process of in vitro fertilization inherently destroys embryos that are not yet planted in the womb, and the process of abortion destroys an embryo that has progressed to a fetus that is in the womb. Both end a positive future life. Both end a possible future life. Republicans want to have it both ways. Is it because they realize it would be political suicide to condemn IVF? These profound personal decisions should be left to the women who have to agonize over making them. That was written by Sandra Quintero of Ames. Here's a short one. Biden is the right person for this moment. This is written by Robin Mensching of West Des Moines. Joe Biden is too old. Ha! I'll give you that he moves like an older person, but his mind is sharp as a knife. He's been in training his whole life for the moment in time to save American democracy. Those are the two short letters. USA Opinion page now. Moving to that, going to read this one here. The very top of it says, on Ramadan, we struggle with guilt on Gaza. This is written by Rami Nashashibi, who's opinion coordinator, a MacArthur Foundation fellow, is founder and executive director of the Inner City Muslim Action Network. Dateline is Chicago, and it says, according to a tradition attributed to the Prophet Muhammad, God is with the brokenhearted. That idea may provide some respite for many of us on the eve of Ramadan, those entering this Muslim holy month with shattered hearts. Even as someone who has done his best to avoid social media, I turned on NPR the other day long enough to hear the wailing of Renea Abu Anza, who had spent a decade and three rounds of in vitro fertilization to become pregnant. But now her five-month-old twins and a dozen other relatives have been crushed to death under the rubble in Gaza after an Israeli airstrike. Rania and her family were seeking refuge in Rafah because it had been declared a safe zone by the Israeli troops, who have driven most of the 1.7 million displaced Palestinians like her into the very space they are now bombing indiscriminately. Every day, our emails, WhatsApp groups, and social media feeds are flooded with dozens of such accounts. Motez Abdullah, a Palestinian-American father and my friend in Chicago, and I have talked about the guilt, helplessness, and rage that have driven many of us to some very steep emotional edges since October 7. I've sobbed more in the last 5 months than I have my entire life, Motaz said. My conversation with Motaz is not unique, as I have spoken to dozens of other Palestinian-American friends and family expressing similar sentiments. At this point, I often find myself easily triggered and brought to tears by any encounter with stories, voices, and illustrations of trauma and injustice. A few weeks ago, I experienced one of those encounters toward the end of a tour at the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. Somewhere between the holograms of actors taking on the persona, story, and voices of formerly enslaved people and the exhibit on mass incarceration, I broke down and had to be consoled by a colleague. Perhaps it was the very familiar and often invisible stories of mass incarceration that I hear and experience as the executive director of the Inner City Muslim Action Network. Maybe it was the video of the Reverend Martin Luther King delivering the last few sentences of his, quote, I've been to the mountaintop, end quote, speech that night before his assassination. Something about those prophetic words appealing to a beleaguered community hold on to the vision of a promised land. Most likely, it was a combination of everything. If the carnage continues during the month-long Ramadan, we are bracing ourselves for more searing impact on our souls. Fasting from dawn to sunset, by many accounts, increases one's emotional sensitivity and empathy. More than 30,000 Palestinians lie dead in Gaza and thousands remain missing, most likely buried under the rubble. The Gaza Strip is in utter ruin, and even a complete cessation of violence would still come with the tremendous emotional burden of confronting the actual extent of the decimation funded by our tax dollars. With no ceasefire, prepare for more heartbreaking images. Yet, with no ceasefire in place, we are preparing ourselves for more images of children strewn out on the floors of emergency rooms covered in debris or dying of starvation. Perhaps consolation in our painful brokenness comes from prayer and the opportunity to bring parts of our fractured communities together this Ramadan. These are spaces often pried open by our young artists, activists, dreamers, and spiritual seekers who still believe in the integral power of bringing us together to hear and identify with each other's pain. Such gatherings occur in intimate halls or large outdoor arenas, similar to the venue where young hip-hop artist Marcus Morton, known as Red Veal, I believe it is, performed in November. Toward the end of his set, Red Veal asked his DJ to scream the names of thousands of Gazans under the age of 4 killed in 5 months of bombings. Quote, "Nobody on this list made it to the age of 4. Not one. It's not complicated," end quote. If it takes a 19-year-old Maryland rapper to stand in the middle of our broken human family and defy all our complicated reasons not to be accountable for Palestinian suffering, then so be it. Maybe the wisdom in confronting our broken hearts this Ramadan is to see the opening in the breaking. In this poem of beauty and breaking, Grammy-nominated poet Amir Suleiman lays this out. "Who would want their heart broken, but now that mine has been split open, I wonder who would want their heart closed? Ever, can you drink from the coconut without striking it? Can you smell the aloes wood without lighting it? So much sweetness is violent, so much beauty in breaking. Can you birth without bleeding and crying and breathing and dying?" That was it. Can our hearts breaking lead to an identification with suffering that provides any hope to Rania and the tens of thousands of grieving mothers like her in Gaza? Can it lead to further unified action to get this U.S. president to take serious accountability for his complicity in the genocidal assault on the people of Gaza? Can it push our elected officials to demand a permanent ceasefire agreement? Can we get our president to leverage the billions we give Israel to demand compliance with international law? If so, then maybe all that heartbreaking is the spiritual healing and medicine we need during this Ramadan.
Thank you, Doug. Now we'll move on to sports, and here's what's on TV today. I won't be able to list everything for you, but I'll give you some of the highlights. We got men's college basketball, the ACC Atlantic Coast Tournament, Georgia Tech versus Notre Dame. That's the first round game at 2 p.m. At 4:30 p.m. on the ACC Network in the Atlantic Coast Tournament, it's Louisville versus North Carolina State. 5 p.m. on ESPN2, the America East Tournament, New Hampshire at Vermont. That's a semifinal game. 6:30 p.m. on ESPNU in the Southland Conference Tournament. It's New Orleans Lamar winner versus McNeese State in the semifinals. 7 p.m. on the ACC Network in the ACC Tournament. It's Miami of Florida versus Boston College. That's a first-round game. On CBS Sports Network in the Colonial Conference Tournament, Charleston Towson winner versus Stony Brook Hofstra winner. That'll be the championship game. Also 7 p.m. on ESPN Horizon League Tournament, Cleveland State, Oakland, Michigan winner versus UW-Milwaukee Northern Kentucky winner in the championship, which takes place in Indianapolis. On ESPN2 in the Northeast Tournament, it's Wagner at Merrimack for the championship. 8:30 p.m. on ESPNU, it's the Big Sky Tournament, Sacramento State versus Weber State, Montana State winner. That's a semifinal game. And then at 9 p.m. on ESPN, in the West Coast Tournament, Santa Clara, St. Mary's of California winner versus San Francisco Gonzaga winner in the championship game. And that game is taking place in Las Vegas. 9:30 p.m., the Summit League Tournament, South Dakota State, St. Thomas winner versus Denver Omaha winner in the championship at 9:30 on CBS Sports Networks, and that's in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And then 11 p.m. on ESPN2 in the Big Sky Tournament, it's Idaho State versus the Montana Portland State winner in a semifinal game from Boise, Idaho. Women's college basketball, 4 p.m. on ESPNU. It's the West Coast Tournament. Apparently, the teams are to be determined. That'll be the championship game that's taking place in Las Vegas. 4:30 p.m. on CBS Sports Network. The Summit League teams are to be determined for the championship, which takes place in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And then at 9 p.m. ESPN2, the Big 12 Tournament. It says teams are to be determined here, but I'm pretty sure it is Iowa State versus Texas. And that's, of course, taking place down in Kansas City, Missouri. NBA basketball tonight at 7:30 p.m. on TNT. It's Philadelphia at New York. And at 10 p.m. on TNT, it's Minnesota at the L.A. Clippers.
Okay, I'm going to read from that sports section story here, and then may not finish it. If I don't, we'll do the best we can to wrap it up. Iowa State's Lipsey is a first-team All-Big 12 selection, written by Randy Peterson. It says, three reporters were chatting with Coach T.J. Otzelberger in a hotel lobby the morning after Iowa State lost against Pittsburgh in last season's NCAA tournament first round. We were conversing about the next season when Otzelberger uttered what would prove to be prophetic about Taman Lipsey. He's going to get in the gym and continue to work on shooting the ball from the perimeter, Otzelberger told us before the team headed back to Ames. He continued, the next step for him is going to be his confidence in that shot. We have belief in him. We're going to continue every day to work diligent. That's the step I know he's going to want to take now that he's seen what defenses are going to do and how they're going to play him, end quote. During multiple sessions, a day, every day last summer, Lipsey shot and shot and shot. The result? Coaches named him to a first-team spot on their All-Big 12 team that was revealed Sunday evening. Not only was he on the first team, but he also was on the specialty All-Defense team. Iowa State's Keyshawn Gilbert was a second-team pick, and Milan Momcilovic was on the All-Freshman team. Coaches picked Kelvin Sampson as their coach of the year after he led the Cougars to the regular season title in their first Big 12 season. A sophomore, Lipsey enters this week's Big 12 tournament leading the team in assists, steals, and minutes. Excuse me. He's number two in scoring and rebounding. That's a significant upgrade from his freshman season. At times as a rookie, opponents dared him to shoot. A 20% three-point shooter, he posed little threat from distance. After essentially living in the practice gym last off-season, that three-point shooting improved to 36.8%. His scoring average went from 7.3 points to a game to 12.5. Now he's on opponents' defensive radar. It was a tough year, but I think I learned from it and improved from it, Lipsey said during the season. Houston's Jamal Shedd was the Big 12 Player of the Year, Kansas Hunter Dickinson, the top newcomer, and Baylor's Jacoby Walter was the top freshman. First team, Jamal Shedd, Houston, Taman Lipsey, Iowa State, Hunter Dickinson, Kansas, Kevin McClure, Jr., Kansas, and Dylan Dessou, Texas. The second team, Ray J. Dennis, Baylor, L.J. Cryer, Houston, Kashawn Gilbert, Iowa State. Emmanuel Miller, TCU. Max Abmas, A-B-M-A-S, from Texas. Third team, Jalen Bridges, Baylor. Jacoby Walter, Baylor. Yvonne Roberts, Houston. Pop Isaacs, Texas Tech. Darian Williams, Texas Tech. So that's the Big 12 story about Lipsy. And I'm going to turn it over here to Scott.
All right, I'll go over a couple quick headlines. First up, Iowa State wrestling, men's wrestling, wins first Big 12 team title since 2009. And the Iowa State women's basketball team pounds the Oklahoma Sooners and returns to the Big 12 final. That'll take place today. And the University of Iowa men's wrestling team lands fourth at the Big Ten meet. Let's see if I can find anything else here. And let's talk about Iowa college basketball. After shrinking at an inopportune time, Iowa's last hope is in Minneapolis. Peyton Sanford delivered a description of Iowa's 2023-2024 regular season, a roller coaster ride that came to an uninspiring end on Sunday. "I would say we've had our backs against the walls pretty much since early December," Sanford said. Now staring down the Big Ten tournament, where a matchup with Ohio State on Thursday awaits, Iowa still finds itself in that very position. In a game where it could not afford to do so, Iowa laid an egg. Sunday's high-stakes matchup with Illinois presented an opportunity to take a major step into getting into the NCAA tournament. Instead, the Hawkeyes did not lead for a single second on Sunday as the Illini put together a wire-to-wire 73-61 victory. Now facing unlikely odds, Iowa will try to rekindle some magic from its run at the Big Ten tournament in 2022. We'll go ahead and now and switch over to Doug for Dear Abby.
And father's death threat leads to change in family dynamics. Dear Abby, while I was visiting my father-in-law, a heated conversation turned violent. My husband, Rob, was helping his dad and a neighbor with a house project. When Rob's dad became upset at him, he lifted the power saw he was holding, turned it on, and motioned toward Bob, saying, quote, "You're lucky I don't slit your throat," end quote. He said some other unkind things, and we left. He has not reached out to my husband since, and Rob has deleted his phone number. His dad sent me a text taking to no responsibility for his actions and blaming Rob, which is why we have decided to cut ties for now. We have a teen daughter, and my father-in-law has also texted her. We do not want her around him, and Rob wants to instruct her not to respond. The day his father acted like this was also the first anniversary of the passing of his long-term girlfriend, who was more like a wife. Should we tell our daughter not to respond to his messages? Threatened in Oregon, it is signed. Dear Threatened, Abby writes, your daughter is old enough to know what is going on and be able to respond to her grandfather's text. I'm not sure how you could stop her. However, she should also be made aware that, in a moment of anger, her grandfather threatened to kill her father, which is why you have decided it is safer to keep your distance. At the least, dear old dad owes his son an apology. And here's one. Dear Abby, is it acceptable to put someone on speakerphone without informing them? I recently had a conversation with my younger sister about our mother's health issues. In the background, I heard someone make a comment to her about something I had said about our parents. When I asked, who is that? She said it was her live-in boyfriend of 2 years and that I had been on speakerphone the entire time. I immediately ended the conversation. Please understand that no one in our family has met or spoken to this man other than my sister. To me, he's a stranger. I felt it was inappropriate for him to listen in our conversation, whether it was a personal family issue or not. I'm not sure if violated is the right description for how I felt after hanging up, but it didn't sit well with me, even though nothing derogatory had been said. Am I behind the times, or did my sister make an error in judgment? I have not discussed my displeasure with her, but I plan to. My wife agrees with me, but says I should drop it and be mindful of my sister's actions going forward. Overheard in Florida is how that is signed. Here is the answer. Dear Overheard, the rule of etiquette is that the person you call should ask before putting someone on speaker if someone else is present. That said, Sissy and her boyfriend have been living together for 2 years. I doubt she keeps secrets from him. What she hears, she shares with him. The next time you want to discuss some family business with her, open the conversation by telling her you would like her to please not put you on speaker. Then cross your fingers and hope she complies. So that's Dear Abby for today. And before we get into the close of the day, I'll let you know the weather. I think I've got the right day here. Yep, this is Tuesday, March 12. We've got warm with clouds and sun coming in. It was just perfect. It's going to be even more perfect going out of here. And the low tonight is 44. On Wednesday, the high is 69, the low of 51, and Thursday, 61 and 34. Friday is 54 high, 35 low, so it's cooling off a little bit, but it's livable, I can tell you that. Sunday gets down to 40, and so a Monday on the 40s. That's a look at the weather. So that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Doug Kretzinger. My partner at the microphone has been Scott Splevic. Earlier you heard Sally Ortigas and Teresa Whitaker. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. I want to thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.